This is Radio MD COVID-19 Weekly, your source for COVID-19 news from the front lines of healthcare. I'm Caitlin White. I hope you're doing your best to enjoy your June thus far. Later in our episode, we discuss child abuse during the COVID-19 pandemic, and our healthcare hero takes us to the cafeteria at Shriners Hospital for Children in Portland, Oregon. But now our news update. Protests continue to rage across the country, even as the COVID-19 pandemic continues at the same time. So how can you stay safe from the virus if you feel the draw to hit the streets in your city? Most of the tips are the same we've been seeing implemented for months. Stay 6 feet apart while you march, wear a mask when you enter a crowded space, and bring hand sanitizer for you and to share with others. But some experts and even state officials are urging protesters to get tested for COVID-19 as well. Epidemiologist Bill Miller told NPR this week, you might have a small number of infected people who are particularly active, moving around in the crowd. If one or more of these people are shouting often, maybe not wearing a mask, the situation is a setup for a super spreader event. Being outdoors, of course, seems to reduce the risk of exposure because the virus can't survive long in sunlight and there's better air circulation, but it's no guarantee against infection. A coronavirus vaccine could require not one, but two shots. With more on why that might be the case is Radio MD's Scott Webb.
We've all heard the exciting news that a COVID-19 vaccine could be available much sooner than originally projected. One downside to a vaccine is that there's a high likelihood that it will require a two-dose series a month or so apart, with the possibility of a booster a few years later, adding to the complexity and cost of administration and distribution. Of the more than 100 vaccine candidates in various stages of testing, almost all are expected to require two doses, which for most of us won't be a problem. Reporting for Radio MD News, I'm Scott Webb.
Have you been having weird dreams while in quarantine? Well, you're not the only one. Radio MD's Bill Klaproth has more.
Since the coronavirus pandemic pressed pause on our lives, America's time of sleep has jumped nearly 20%, resulting in more dreams. Or should I say, vivid dreams. More than 87% of Americans have had unusual or bizarre dreams since the pandemic began, according to a sleep standard survey of 1,000 dreamers in the United States, says a story in WebMD. So if this has happened to you, don't worry. Nightmares, dreams, and sleep disturbances are common in times of trauma and disaster. And research suggests that dreaming about scary stuff is a necessary defense mechanism. It makes our brains better able to handle and react to the real-life stress and emotions. So it's actually good for us. So tuck yourself in, say goodnight, and here's to happy dreaming. For Radio MD News, I'm Bill Klaproth.
Instead of planes flying in and out of Uruguay's International Airport, cars have been arriving nightly for people to enjoy a socially distanced movie in the safety of their own vehicle. The Guardian reports among the movies being screened are Bohemian Rhapsody, The Lion King, and Joker, for around 100 cars each showing. The airport's toilets have been opened for moviegoers who must wear face masks outside of their cars. The promoters behind the project are planning on putting on music shows and stand-up comedy as well for the drive-in audience. And, of course, popcorn and McDonald's can be ordered via WhatsApp. Our healthcare hero today takes us to the cafeteria at Shriners Hospital for Children in Portland, Oregon. The hospital here is trying to provide a grocery shopping option for staff that allows them to purchase a box of groceries from the hospital rather than going to the grocery store. This project is led by the manager of this department, Jackie DeVore. And Jackie, tell me why you decided to set up a shopping option in your cafeteria for staff.
Well, there were actually multiple things that sort of collided together, one of which is when the virus hit, we started getting emails from our food service vendors saying, we have lots of stock, we're dropping the price because we're not moving this due to the restaurant closures. So that was kind of the first sign, like, okay, how can we take advantage of this? Secondly, as time went on, people were trying to minimize their contact with people outside their households. So trying to avoid a trip to the grocery store would be nice. And so we thought, well, maybe we could sell boxes of food to staff to save them a trip to the grocery store, limit their exposure to the virus, and maybe offer some things that were becoming in short supply, like rice and beans, for example. Yeah.
That kind of leads me into my next question. What kind of stuff are you selling? Is it produce, or what's the grocery store kind of look like?
Okay. We always start with what protein we're going to put in there, and we offer a, quote, meat box and a vegetarian option. So, for example, 1 week it might be hamburgers and chicken. For the vegetarian option, we have garden burgers, vegetarian sausage. We have some Beyond Meat we've offered, the meat substitute that's very close to, you know, burger. And then from there, we try to put in some sort of grain, either rice or most of the time it's been rice. And then dried beans or peas, we've had navy beans, black beans, lentils. And from there, we put in as many fruits and vegetables, most of which are fresh, because that's something that people need to shop for more frequently. And so maybe this keeps them again out of the supermarket. We try to be as nutritious as possible.
And what have you heard from your staff? Are you seeing people, you know, utilizing this option?
Yes, we are. In fact, I've asked a few staff, you know, give me sort of some feedback on how this has worked for you. And I might add at this point that as a result, once we started offering this, we had multiple staff in the building come forward and say, I'd like to buy a box for a staff person that may be struggling.
Oh, wow.
And so we've had a large number of donators, and we've had several who've taken them up on it. And so, for example, from someone who received a donated box, I have this quote. I mean, I have kind of a little quote that I could read if you want to incorporate that in.
Yeah, sure,
please. Yeah. So this person stated, I'm a single parent who receives government subsidy for food. I love my job at Shriners Hospital because I've always felt I'm a part of a team that works together. The donation of food I receive reaffirms that belief. At a time when supporting each other in our communities couldn't be more important, I'm so glad to be supported by them.
That's really cool to see tangible evidence of, you know, what you're doing is actually helping.
It really is, and it was the little silver lining that came out of the project. And we continue to have people that offer, you know, if someone needs a box. So it's a very generous group of people.
Jackie, is there anything else you want to add about the project you're working on here at Shriners?
Well, the other, I think the last piece was to why we moved on with this was also to help our food vendors that were kind of holding all this food stock, and they were donating what they could, but, you know, they're a business. They'd rather sell it. So we were able to, you know, take advantage of their offerings and help them out and help us out. So it was sort of a win-win for everybody.
Yeah. Getting the food where it should be going, right?
Into right.
The mouths of workers.
Right. Yeah. So, and I think I have another quote that I could share.
Please, yeah.
Yeah. Someone who purchased a box. The food boxes have been an unexpected benefit to our family, including excellent quality meat, fruit, vegetables, and staples. They have helped save both dollars and trips to the grocery store, not to mention the fact that they often include hard-to-find items like rice and hamburger. The hamburgers cooked on the grill are absolutely delicious, unquote.
Oh, I love it. That's so cool. Well, Jackie, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it, and everything you're doing sounds really incredible.
Thank you. Thanks for the interview.
With families stuck at home, a bleak side effect of the pandemic has been an increase in abuse. Joining us today to talk about child abuse during the COVID-19 pandemic is Dr. Melissa Peters, an associate professor and medical director of the CHIP Center at Children's of Alabama. Dr. Peters, by now we've all heard stories in the news about the possibility of domestic abuse and child abuse increasing because of the pandemic and the shelter-in-place rules. Can you tell us how the pandemic might be affecting families in this way?
There are several ways that families are being affected currently. One of the biggest ones, of course, is financial, with people being furloughed, with people losing their jobs, with people just not being able to work. A large percentage of our population If they don't go to work, they don't get paid. And we certainly know that financial stresses are one of the risk factors for children being abused. Another big one that we've not seen before is everybody having to spend all this time together under one roof. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of stress on people to have to spend all that time together, especially for kids, because they're used to going to school. They're used to that type of routine. Here they are cooped up inside all day long, and behavior issues can come up. Sometimes those end up being triggers for abuse to start. The other thing that we also think about are families recombining in different ways. Sometimes you have folks that stay with you. When I ask folks who lives with you, they will tell me who permanently lives in the house. But asking the question who stays with you tends to be a different answer, because there are a lot of people with transient housing. And so there may be more folks than just that usual group of people that reside in that home. So there are a lot of concerns that we had as soon as these shelter-in-place social distancing recommendations started to come down. I think all of us had been concerned that we were going to see an increase in child abuse. Some communities have definitely seen that, talking with colleagues across the country. One thing we're certainly seeing here in the mid-central Alabama area is an increase in domestic violence. And I think that's happening across the country as well. And certainly domestic violence is a risk factor for child abuse. It also is incredibly difficult and stressful on children. Anyone who thinks that their children don't realize that something is going down in the house when it comes to domestic violence, I would challenge that assumption. Kids are very, very smart, and they are incredible observers of their environment. And it also creates a very stressful environment for that child.
Another side effect of the pandemic is, of course, schools and daycares, places like those being closed. And kids aren't in touch with teachers and other trusted adults outside of their homes. How could this be addressed?
I think that's a big topic of discussion amongst educators, certainly, because that was another concern we had, that kids are going to be outside of that normal network of adults that they see that are not residing in their home. And I wouldn't just throw in teachers, daycare folks, I would throw in also faith communities, because a lot of faith communities have had to curtail their in-person worship services. There are a lot of places that kids get seen outside of the home, and that is also going to be significantly curtailed. One of the things that I do recommend folks think about is talking with the families of your patients. If you're a pediatrician, if you're seeing patients, you know, kids in your practice, talk with them about keeping in touch with other families with kids that they know. Watching Zoom, seeing if there is anything unusual, anything that the child seems afraid of, if it seems like the child is being coached from off camera, just keep your eyes out, because things can be very subtle on a regular day. This, I think, is an opportunity for us to think not just about the children that we directly care for, but the whole village, really, that we all create as a society for the kids that we know.
As we look forward to a hopeful post-pandemic time, hopefully in the near future, what do you anticipate? What do you think we will maybe even learn or take away from this time?
I am really interested to see what the numbers are in terms of reports, in terms of substantiated abuse from an investigatory perspective. I'm really interested to see that. I think that it is probably going to increase over time as these stresses increase on people. There are also a group of kids who are verbal, who may be being abused right now, but won't disclose until they are out of that environment where they're being abused and they feel safer. So we are anticipating a surge in our numbers of kids who are verbal once things start to open up and we're seeing less of the social distancing and kids getting back out into their usual communities outside of their home.
For anyone who may be listening who has been impacted by the pandemic in this way, do you have any resources online, socially distant ways that people can turn to for help?
I would encourage folks to talk with their primary care doctors and pediatricians, first of all, because there are often local resources that you can access that can be very, very helpful. And not just resources as a place to talk, but resources as far as food banks, as far as other forms of support within the community. Many communities, many states have a child abuse hotline. We have one here in Alabama that you can just look up online where caregivers can talk with somebody and talk about the difficulties they're having caring for their child or concerns they may have of abuse. I also would encourage folks to think very seriously in this time. If you have a concern that a child is being abused, do consider reporting it, even if you're not a mandated reporter. The only way we find out if abuse is going on is through investigation. And these kids, most of them don't have a voice. Nobody else is going to speak for them. And so if there is a significant concern, then you can certainly call your local child protective services. You can call your local child advocacy center. Child advocacy centers are where counseling occurs for kids with suspected abuse. Formal forensic interviews occur. Call your local medical child abuse center if you have one at a children's hospital nearby. They can often refer you to resources that may be helpful.
Dr. Peters, is there anything else about this issue that I didn't touch on that you want to talk about?
The one other thing that I think ties into the issue of keeping your eyes and ears open for child abuse is also domestic violence. As a profession, as physicians, we are not always so great about asking folks if they feel safe in their homes, if anyone is getting injured in their homes. I think now is an especially important time for us as medical providers to be screening. And if anyone listening is in an environment where they feel they are unsafe, they feel their children are unsafe, reach out in your community to a domestic violence hotline. Very, very important.
This has been Radio MD COVID-19 Weekly. Reach out to us at COVID19@radiomd.com. That's now just COVID19@radiomd.com. We always love to hear from you. I hope you are staying well during all of this unrest nationwide. I'm Caitlin White. Stay safe and 6 feet apart.